It's a great pleasure to welcome you all to this fifth, we believe, in the series of prestigious KEPSAR external speaker series. And really, we have a very distinguished speaker for you this afternoon in terms of Steve Squires. As you will know, KEPSAR is the principal research centre within the Faculty of Science, covering the disciplines of Earth, planetary, space and astronomical science, and indeed has been led in a distinguished way by Bob Spicer until relatively recently. And I think this is Bob's legacy in terms of having just stood down as director of KEPSAR with John Zanecki taking over. But this is Bob's legacy to KEPSAR in terms of a distinguished speaker that he arranged during his tenure. And indeed, on behalf of Bridget Hayward, the Pro Vice Chancellor, research and staff within the OU, could I welcome you all, and indeed Steve Squires, for being here this afternoon. And indeed a great pleasure in being able to introduce Steve to offer his talk this afternoon. Many of you will know that Steve is Professor of Astronomy at Cornell University in New York, with a distinguished career in the area of planetary science research. And it says here, in terms of focus on large solid bodies in the solar system, and indeed an extensive involvement in the Mars Exploration Rover mission. In addition to his work at Cornell University, Steve previously had a role at the NASA Ames Research Center as a postdoctoral researcher, and he has a particular interest in specializing in planetary gamma ray and X-ray spectroscopy. He's had extensive involvement in various NASA planetary exploration missions, and indeed with a particular interest in exploration on Mars. And I was very interested to read this issue about you being featured in ABC's News Persons of the Week for January the 9th, 2004. And it was noted by anchor Peter Jennings on the World News Tonight that he has gotten us all excited, which I'm sure is something you're going to emulate this afternoon. So can I just then hand over to Colin Pillinger, who has a personal contribution to make in terms of formally inviting you to make your presentation. Colin.
Thank you, Phil. It's a very great pleasure to see this lecture theatre full again, with people avidly waiting to hear about the exploration of Mars. And it couldn't be a better person who is giving that lecture than Steve Squires. And I really mean a better person. Before I'd even met this guy, I insulted his mission. I was under duress at the time. I didn't have any money, and NASA had just announced that he was going to take two rovers to Mars, and I was sitting in front of a large number of journalists who said, "Why are you bothering? Steve Squires is going to detect life on Mars." And my answer to that was that no, he isn't going to detect life on Mars. He's going sightseeing. Well, this is probably going to be the most stupendous sightseeing tour that you're ever likely to witness. Two rovers that were planned to go for 90 days have been operating for 3 years now and have been feeding us back visions to feast our eyes upon. Well, Steve certainly never bore any grudges to me. He was the first person who contacted me from the outside world on Christmas morning 2003 to say, "Don't worry, it'll be all right, it'll turn up." Now, I have a last little anecdote to tell you, Steve, about this, and it's a warning that your talk will actually be well received here, I assure you. But I know somebody from the Beagle team who sat through one of your presentations, and when the lights came up at the end, the tears were streaming down his cheeks. The person sat next to him, looked at him and said, "What's the matter?" And he said, "I was just thinking about what might have been." So there are a lot of people in this room who are thinking about what might have been, but we couldn't be listening to a nicer person tell us what might have happened. The floor is yours, Steve.
Thank you very much, Colin, for that kind introduction. Today is day 1012 of our 90-day mission to Mars. We're very tired, but it's still going well. And what I'm going to try to do for you today is in a very brief hour, give you a whirlwind tour of some of the highlights of the science results from the mission. The background of this slide, by the way, I should mention, is a crater at Meridiani Planum that we have named Beagle Crater. All of the craters at the Meridiani site we have named after famous ships of exploration, and this is, of course, named after HMS Beagle, but is also very much a tip of our hats to our friends and colleagues here at the Open University in the UK for all the work that you did setting out to Mars at the same time that we did. So I'm going to talk a little bit today about the job that's been done at Mars by these two vehicles. You can see Spirit in the foreground, all tricked out here and ready to go to Mars. You can just see Opportunity in the background here. Doesn't have her wheels on yet. I'm the handsome guy in the white suit here. This is a picture that was taken in Florida coming on close to 4 years ago, about 3.5 years ago now, before we sent these things off to Mars. The science payload for the vehicles, which I'll just talk about briefly, is shown on this slide. It sort of comes in two parts. One part is supported by this big, fat, white stovepipe of a mast here, and it consists of two instruments. One is the PanCam color panoramic imagers at the top. Those are the ones that produce the nice high-resolution color images. And then down inside the vehicle, where it's warm and mechanically stable, we have an infrared spectrometer called MINITESS. That's short for Miniature Thermal Emission Spectrometer. And that's a Michelson interferometer that works over a range from 5 to 29 microns. And it uses that tube of the mast as a periscope. And there's a scanning mirror assembly at the top that we use to get the same view of the countryside as the cameras get. On the front end of the vehicle, then, there's an arm shown right here. It's a 5-degree of freedom robotic manipulator with a shoulder, an elbow, and a wrist. And on the end of the arm, there are four devices. One we call the microscopic imager. It's not a true microscope in the optical sense. It's more like a geologist hand lens with a resolution of 30 microns per pixels. Two more spectrometers, an alpha particle X-ray spectrometer for doing elemental chemistry and a Mossbauer spectrometer for doing the mineralogy of iron-bearing species. And then a device we call the RAT, the rock abrasion tool, which is a diamond-tip grinding tool that's able to grind away the outer millimeters of a rock and expose the interior for the instruments to look at. I'll begin with the results from Spirit, which landed at Gusev Crater. Gusev Crater is the large blue crater that you see in the middle of this view. It's about 160 kilometers in diameter, and what caused us to choose this as a landing site is the fact that there is a large water-carved channel that flows into the crater. And so the hypothesis that we went here to test was the idea that there had once been a lake in this crater, and so we went looking for layered sedimentary rocks. This is the view that we got when we first landed on the surface. It was very enticing in that it was nice and flat and easy to drive on and lots of rocks. But even in this first view, we got a sense that the rocks didn't look very sedimentary to us. we landed, as it turns out, about 2.5 kilometers away from a rather spectacular range of hills that we named the Columbia Hills after the Columbia Space Shuttle. At a distance of 2.5 kilometers away, given that we had vehicles that were designed to last for 90 days and drive 600 meters over their lifetime, these hills looked impossibly far away at the time. As it's turned out, we've spent most of the mission in the Columbia Hills, including driving to the summit of this mountain right here. We initially started by just concentrating on the rocks right around us. This is Adirondack, the first rock that we looked at carefully. And we hit this thing with everything we had. We drilled a hole in it with our RAT. We looked at it with all our spectrometers. And what we learned was that this is not a sedimentary rock at all. Here's the Mossbauer spectrum of it. The minerals that you see present are olivine, magnetite, pyroxene. So just what you would find in a magnetite-bearing basalt. Fe2 plus to Fe total of 0.8, so it's not very oxidized. The mini test mineralogy, this is the infrared spectrometer mineralogy, and you see pyroxene, plagioclase, olivine. This is the normative mineralogy from the alpha particle X-ray spectrometer. Plagioclase, pyroxenes, olivine, magnetite. All the instruments tell the same story. This is a magnetite-bearing, olivine-rich basalt, and all the rocks around it are that too. It turns out that while, yes, there probably was a lake here long ago, what's happened is those sediments have subsequently been buried by lavas, and we had no access to them. So this is a fairly bitter disappointment. And in fact, if the mission had lasted only 90 Martian days, all we would have seen would have been this lava. This shows a map that shows where we went for the first 156 sols of the mission. We landed here, drove to Bonneville Crater. This is a place where we hoped that maybe the impact would have penetrated through the lava and down into something else. It didn't. We just found more of the same stuff there. And so by day 100 of the mission, we were here near the rim of the crater. The warranty on the vehicle had just expired. And we had to decide what to do. And what we decided to do was to just trust the vehicle and trust the people that had built it and sprint as fast as we could towards the base of the Columbia Hills. We arrived at the base of Husband Hill on Sol 156 of the mission, and life has been very interesting ever since. This shows Husband Hill as it looked when we first arrived at the base of it. To give you a sense of scale and to show you how we climbed it, this is a NASA provided version. You can see. I apologize for the Imperial units. I thought I should at least do a special version of this for you, so to give you a proper sense of scale. That's how tall Husband Hill is. We worked our way slowly and laboriously up the hill, first arriving here on about Sol 150, spending a lot of time negotiating this north-facing slope. You can see north is this direction here. Negotiating this north-facing slope of the hill. The reason we went on the north-facing slope is by this time it was Martian winter. And this site is in the southern hemisphere. The sun is low in the sky. By going on the north-facing slope, we can tilt the solar arrays towards the sun and rather dramatically improve our power output. In fact, had it not been for the topography of this hill, we would have not survived our first winter on Mars. I want to give you a sense of the degree of geologic complexity and diversity within the Columbia Hills. This is a very busy plot, but it makes one simple point. What you see plotted here is data from our alpha particle X-ray spectrometer. On the horizontal axis are some of the elements, the chemical elements that we detect with that instrument. And what we've done here is ratio the composition of various rocks that we have found in the Columbia Hills to the composition of those basalts that we saw out on the plains on an element-by-element basis. So this is a given rock. We have different classes of rocks. They're named after certain rocks that we have found that have those characteristics. And this is five of what is now a dozen different rock classes that we have found. And it's ratioed to the Adirondack class basalts, the stuff that was out on the plains. And notice it's log scale. A couple points here. One is that it's all over the place. There's an enormous range of compositions here. And the second is many rocks, distinct rock types with very substantial differences from one another. So we're seeing enormous variations in the geochemistry within these hills. It's a bunch of different rock types jumbled up together with substantial diversity. And again, this is five of the rock types. There's that many, again, that we've discovered since this particular plot was done. I'm not going to try to cover all the different rock types, but I'm going to hit three of them to just give you a sense of the diversity of rocks that we see. One is a set of rocks that we call Clovis-class rocks, and these are the ones that are dominant down here on the west spur of Husband Hill where we first came up against the hills. These rocks are commonly finely layered. The image in the right and the lower left here are images taken with our microscopic imager. The scale across those images is 3 centimeters. So these are very finely layered rocks in some instances. This is another microscopic imager close-up of a particular rock called lutefisk. And this shows the range in grain sizes. What we find is these are clastic rocks composed of grains, but they have an enormous range in grain sizes, ranging from down near the resolution limit of the imager, which is 30 microns per pixel, up to some grains that are millimeters in size. So very poor sorting, speaking of some kind of fairly energetic process involved in forming these rocks. These are infrared spectra, just two spectra on two different spots on this particular rock here, which is named Cocomama. And the shape of the spectrum, particularly in this region here, is indicative of something that looks very similar to a basaltic glass. So an indication that we may be seeing some kind of amorphous material here. In contrast to the rocks out on the plains, which were really tough on the rat, I mean, the rat's a diamond tip grinding tool, spins at 3,000 RPM. We were able to grind into the basalts on the plains, but they were very hard, very difficult to grind into, took a long time to go just a few millimeters. This stuff is very, very soft. This is a 9 millimeter rat hole that we did in less than an hour. So this is very soft, very easily abraded rock. So it's saying something about the physical strength of this is very different from what we've seen before. This shows the chemistry in a little bit more detail. Again, this is the same kind of plot where we've ratioed it to the basalts out on the plains. Broadly basaltic in character and its general chemistry, but there are some significant enhancements, particularly in phosphorus, sulfur, chlorine, bromine, and also nickel. The phosphorus, sulfur, chlorine, bromine, of course, things that you would plausibly find present in salts. The nickel concentration is actually similar to the concentration of nickel that we find in many Martian soils that we attribute to a meteoritic contribution to the composition. This is an interesting plot. This just the green points here are the ones of interest, and this shows a plot of calcium versus sulfur for all of these Clovis class rocks. Very nice correlation between the two, speaking of there being some kind of calcium sulfate being present. Notice that the calcium to sulfur ratio in this particular plot is 1:2, so it's not pure calcium sulfate. There are other sulfates involved as well, but it does speak of calcium sulfate as being one of the components of this rock. This is data for the Clovis class rocks from our Mossbauer spectrometer, and it shows a number of the mineral phases present. The particularly interesting one on here is the blue one, responsible, as you can see, for a number of peaks in the spectrum. That's goethite, and goethite being an iron oxyhydroxide is an indicator of aqueous processes, water being involved somehow in the alteration process. So to kind of summarize this, I've sort of broken it down by what each of the instruments tells us. Each instrument provides us with complementary information. Any one of these things alone would be hard to interpret, but when you put them all together, you can put together sort of a story that might make sense. PanCam, the camera, shows these rocks to be massive in some instances, but in many instances, finely layered. Mini-test shows this component that's fit well by a basaltic glass. The microscopic imager shows it to be a very poorly sorted granular rock. The APXS shows broadly basaltic chemistry, very similar to soils in some respects, with elevations in phosphorus, sulfur, chlorine, bromine, nickel, and certainly a significant contribution from calcium sulfate. The Mossbauer spectrometer doesn't show a lot of primary igneous mineralogy. You don't see a lot of olivine. You don't see pyroxene. What you tend to see is iron oxides and iron oxyhydroxides and very substantial oxidation states, Fe3 plus to Fe total, in excess of 0.8. So they're very, very oxidized rocks. And a rock that's very crumbly and easy to grind with the rat. When you put all of this together, what we interpret this to be is probably impact ejecta. That's what's responsible for the layered appearance and for the nickel concentration. And then this being impact ejected that has undergone some sort of aqueous alteration responsible for deposition of the sulfates and for formation of things like the oxyhydroxides. Working our way onto the northwest flank, we found a very peculiar pair of outcrops. These are among the most interesting rocks that we have found at Gusev. I've been looking for more stuff like this for 2 years since we discovered this stuff, and we haven't found another outcrop of this rock since. This one drives me crazy. It's a rock called Peace. In fact, there were two of them. There was the one called Peace and one called Alligator that were right next to one another. This is Peace. The microscopic imager images show it to be very finely layered in these images that you can see here. When you look at the surface of the rock, as you see in this left-hand image, it looks very encrusted with something. And then when you grind in, and it's a very light tone, and then when you grind into it, what you find is a kind of a salt and pepper looking appearance that consists of dark sand-sized grains embedded in a brighter matrix. When you look at the chemistry and the mineralogy of this rock, it's fascinating. It almost looks for a minute like it didn't even come from the same rock. When you look at the mineralogy with the Mossbauer spectrometer, you see pyroxene, you see olivine, you see magnetite, you see very little oxidation. It looks like a nice, crisp, unaltered basalt. And yet when you look at it with the alpha particle X-ray spectrometer, what you find is substantial elevation in sulfur, and sulfur that correlates with calcium and magnesium. This rock is 15 to 20% magnesium and calcium sulfates. So it's a very, very strange composition. Put the story together here, finely layered. Oh, I forgot to mention the infrared spectrometer. There's so much bound water in this rock, in the sulfates, that you can actually see a six micron bound water feature in the infrared spectrometer. Heavily cemented granular rock with dark sand-sized grains in it. Very high sulfur, 15 to 20% magnesium calcium sulfate. Pyroxene, olivine, high magnetite, Fe3 plus to Fe total, very low. So what this is a magnetite-rich basaltic sandstone that is glued together with magnesium and calcium sulfate. It's a crazy rock. We have not seen anything like this anywhere else on Mars on either one of these sites. You can make up a story about how this forms, so I'll make up a story. Sand was deposited in layers by wind, by water, I don't know, and then briefly wetted by water that evaporated away, forming this sulfate cement. The reason I say briefly wetted is that you still see olivine, you still see pyroxene, you see very, very little alteration of the igneous phases in this rock. It's a very, very peculiar rock, and I wish we could find more of it, but it's been just this one location. Cumberland Ridge. This is another place where we found a completely different class of rock, rocks that we call watchtower class rocks. The textures in these rocks are remarkably diverse. All of them, as you'll see in a moment, have essentially the same elemental composition, but their textures are enormously variable. Some of them are simply massive. Others, like this one, which is named Methuselah, this is a microscopic imager mosaic that's about 12 centimeters across, very, very finely layered. Here's another one, completely different texture, sort of a strange bulbous or globular texture. So there's an enormous range in the texture of these rocks, which I don't claim to understand very well, but certainly they are very finely layered in some instances. The chemistry of all of these rocks on Cumberland Ridge is essentially the same, from one rock to the next, even though there's this tremendous variation in texture, the chemistry is all the same. The chemistry is shown here. It's got a distinctive fingerprint to it. It's high in titanium, high in phosphorus, very low in chromium. And this is something that we see all over this part of Husband Hill. Now, here's the really interesting thing. Despite the fact that the chemistry is constant across all of these rocks, the mineralogy is enormously variable. Okay, these are Mossbauer spectra from a number of different watchtower class rocks, sometimes in very close. Some of these spectra are only like 10, 20, 30 centimeters apart vertically. Enormous variations in mineralogy over vertical distances of half a meter or over lateral distances of 10 meters. Enormous variations in the mineralogy, despite the fact that the chemistry is the same. You look at this rock called Wishstone up in the upper left, Fe3 plus to Fe total of just 0.4. You've got olivine, you've got pyroxene in it. You go down to the lower right here, Fe3 plus to Fe total of 0.95. Substantial amounts of hematite, substantial amounts of goethite. You know, in one hand you've got this highly oxidized rock, and another one, a rock that's very lightly altered. So what's happening is there's some kind of alteration process here that operates on very local scales and is essentially isochemical. It doesn't change the chemistry, it just changes the mineralogy, and it's highly localized. So summarizing, massive, finely layered, bulbous, all sorts of textures. The mini test, the infrared spectrometer, also shows this very variable mineralogy over small length scales. Highly variable textures. Very little variation in the elemental chemistry. It's got this distinctive high titanium, high phosphorus, low chromium fingerprint running through all of it. And while I don't have time to go through the details here, one thing that we see when we look at this particular class of rocks is that its chemistry is exactly what you would get if you mixed two other classes that we've identified other places together. So it appears that there might be some kind of mechanical mixing process that's been involved in the formation. Mineralogy, enormously variable over short length scales, and FE3 plus to FE total is all over the place. So we think this is probably also impact ejecta, again, because of that mixing signature, more than one or more impacts into some kind of mixed target material, and then some kind of highly localized, nearly isochemical alteration process. Because it's so nearly isochemical, even though clearly water's involved at some level, maybe just the steam, it was a very low water to rock ratio, not enough to substantially change the chemistry of this stuff. So we're thinking local, short-lived hydrothermal activity, fumaroles, something like that. But this is very different from what we see in other places. Okay, so we climbed all the way to the summit of Husband Hill. That just shows you several of the rock types that we found along the way. This is an orbital image that was taken before we landed, actually, with the plot laid over it. We then traversed down this ridge, down, back off the summit, down into the lowlands, and we drove to this spot here, this feature here, which we've named home plate. And this is one of the most interesting features that we have seen with the Spirit rover. It's a plateau. It's about 80 or 90 meters in diameter. It's 2 to 3 meters high. It shows some wonderful layering. This is by far the most extensive outcrop of layered bedrock that we've seen at the Spirit site. Broadly speaking, there are two stratigraphic units here, a lower unit that is coarse-grained, an upper unit that is fine-grained. This shows the lower unit grain sizes of up to several millimeters, kind of rounded-looking grains. You can sort of convince yourself that they're reminiscent of lapilli, perhaps. One of the most interesting features that we found here is this right here, which we interpret as a bomb sag. Okay, this is stratigraphically up in this direction, and this clast here, which is clearly embedded in the outcrop, is 4 to 5 centimeters in diameter, and you have very clear and obvious deflection of the layers beneath it. And so we interpret this as a bomb sag, where some kind of bomb fell from the sky into deformable sediments, or deformable materials, I should say, and caused a deformation of those layers. So again, this speaks of a highly energetic explosive process. I suppose you could invent other scenarios for something like this that involve deposition of liquid water and ice rafting and rocks falling out, but that's a little far-fetched, I think, compared to a fairly straightforward explosive explanation for it. The upper unit is much more fine-grained. You can see it here. There is some low-angle cross-stratification in this. When you look at the grains in this upper unit, this is a microscopic imager image of the upper unit. You can see we've brushed off most of it with the rock abrasion tool. The grains are extraordinarily well sorted and extraordinarily rounded. They look, to my eye, almost exactly like these grains, which is an image that we took from a dune field. This is active sand dunes, several hundred meters away from this. Very well rounded, very well sorted, same grain sizes. This is a rock billions of years old. This is active dunes today. So this may be speaking of some kind of aeolian process that was involved in doing the exceptional sorting and rounding of these grains in the upper unit. This just lays out the mineralogy of this stuff. It's an altered basalt. There's nothing particularly exceptional about it. You can see we've made this lovely face here with the eyes and the nose and little face, little mouth down there. But it's an altered basalt, and it's essentially identical in its elemental composition to some blocks of vesicular basalt that we have found nearby. So, putting it all together, what is home plate? First of all, there's a lot that we still don't know about this. We had to really rush through our exploration of home plate. By the time we got to home plate, our second winter on Mars was almost upon us, and we needed to get the vehicle to a place where we could again tilt those solar arrays towards the sun. So we had to kind of rush through it. We think there might be some other outcrops of home plate-like material nearby. We're not certain about that. We hope to answer that question in the coming months. So we're doing field work, and what I'm doing here is kind of cracking open my field notebook and letting you know what we've seen so far here. We still have a lot of work to do. But anyway, summarizing things, that lower unit with the poor sorting, the coarse granules, that bomb sag, all of those point pretty strongly towards some kind of explosive origin, either volcanic or impact. The upper unit certainly could be also impact or volcanic in origin, but that very pronounced sorting and rounding also certainly allow for some reworking of that material by the wind. So we've still got both the impact and volcanic hypotheses on the table at this point. I think most of us on the team are leaning towards an explosive volcanic explanation for this thing because of the fact that the composition of this stuff correlates so closely with the composition of these nearby vesicular basalts. But we're, after winter is over, it's just beginning to become early spring in the southern hemisphere of Mars, but we hope that within the next month or two, we're going to go back to home plate and finish up some unfinished business there. So to try to summarize the geology of Gusev Crater, in particular the Columbia Hills, Husband Hill is not what we came to Gusev Crater looking for. We came looking for water lane sediments. They're nowhere. We haven't seen them. Okay. Husband Hill is something different. It appears to be a sample of the ancient crust of Mars. Impact clearly was a dominant process here. We see lots of evidence for impact ejecta being deposited. We see evidence for mixing of different units. There have been places where we have seen rocks that are composed of clasts of one type of rock that we've seen embedded in a matrix of another type, so where things have been mixed up together. There's been some kind of uplift and deformation that has taken place here, and again, probably associated with impacts. The plains volcanism took place after the formation of the hills. If you do just a geologic map of the stratigraphic relations here, what you see is that the hills are sitting up like an island in a sea of basalts, and the basalts are surrounding them and were deposited later than the formation of the hills. Alteration is very common in the ancient rocks in the hills, but it's very variable in intensity over very short length scales in some instances. Water is implicated, but at really very low water-to-rock ratios. We're not talking about large amounts of water saturating the ground here. We're talking about, in many cases, probably just steam being involved, for example. Very little evidence for the action of surface water. Peace might be an exception, but that's about it. So whatever was going on here with alteration of these rocks and aqueous alteration, it was substantial, but it was brief. These Adirondack-class basalts out on the plains are probably 3.5 billion years old, and they show essentially no alteration at all. So what that says is there was a brief period early in Martian history at this location where there was lots of very violent impact activity, lots of alteration taking place, and then very quickly the aqueous activity stopped. Fun was over. Basalts were in place, and it's been cold and dry ever since. An interesting question that I don't know the answer to, but I'd love to, is Husband Hill typical of what the ancient Martian crust is like? If you think about what you'd expect on early Mars, you see lots of impacts, you see lots of volcanism in the images that you look at from orbit, you see lots of evidence for groundwater. I wouldn't be surprised if much of the ancient highlands of Mars winds up being very much like Husband Hill. Go on to just a little bit of atmospheric science very quickly. These are dust devils. We've seen lots and lots of these. These are a summertime phenomenon. They're a lunchtime phenomenon. They occur typically between about 11 a.m. and 2 o'clock in the afternoon in the summer months. I love this. You can almost see Dorothy and Toto, you know, flying through the scene. Wonderful set of images. This show, one of the things that we do routinely is we monitor the atmospheric opacity. Both of the PanCam cameras have some high-density solar filters that we can use to look at the sun, and by looking at the solar brightness, we can infer how much opacity there is in the atmosphere. This doesn't show an entire Martian year, but it shows part of one for Spirit. Year one is in red, year two is in blue. Notice, first of all, how well the data track from one year to the next. The weather is very repeatable during much of the Martian year. Where it gets non-repeatable, and this is known from Viking, is when you get into the summer months and the dust storms begin to pick up. And this is just about exactly where we are. I mean, today is Sol 1012 for Spirit, so I will not be surprised to see the weather start getting bad very soon. And here's the same thing for Opportunity, and today is Sol 990-something. So we're expecting all hell to break loose weather-wise very soon. One of the things that we can do with our infrared spectrometer is atmospheric sounding. Our infrared spectrometer is designed primarily for doing the mineralogy of rocks, but of course we can use it to look up just as well. And we can use the 15 micron CO2 band to do atmospheric sounding. Now, people have been doing sounding, vertical sounding in the Martian atmosphere using the atmospheric, using the 15 micron CO2 band for decades, but they've always done it from the top looking down. And the problem with that is that while you can see most of the atmosphere well, this part closest to the surface, you're looking through so much column mass of CO2 that it gets very hard to tell very well what's going on. We're at the bottom of the atmosphere looking up. And so what we can do is see that lower portion, which, of course, is the boundary layer. And that's where a lot of the exchange momentum and dust, obviously, and water vapor takes place. So it's an interesting portion of the atmosphere. This just shows a bunch of atmospheric profiles at different times of day. You can see that in the early morning and the nighttime hours, you get this pronounced inversion layer right here. During the daytime, there's a super adiabatic layer that's a couple hundred meters deep, forms about 9 a.m., collapses in the late afternoon. It turns out that super adiabatic layer is where there's a lot of convection going on. This is data that's acquired simply by looking up into the sky and staring continuously and then collecting data on very short intervals. And what you see is a time scale down here in minutes. This is height above the surface, and the color code just shows temperature, with the difference between the hot stuff in red and the cold stuff in blue being plus or minus 3 degrees K. And what you can see is these blobs of gas that go rising up through the atmosphere. And what this is convection in the boundary layer. And this takes place every day between about 10 o'clock in the morning and the mid to late afternoon. Okay, let me move on to Meridiani Planum. This is the landing site for Opportunity. The thing that drew us here is shown very nicely in this slide in this picture on the right, which is data from the thermal emission spectrometer on the Mars Global Surveyor spacecraft. And what it shows in blue is basalt, but the stuff in red and yellow and green here is the occurrence of hematite, an iron oxide that sometimes forms as a consequence of the action of water. And so we went to this site not because of the topography, but because there was this sort of chemical beacon that was visible from space saying that water might once have been here. I threw these pictures in kind of for fun. This shows some images that were taken during the landing process. We had a camera on the vehicle that was looking down at the surface as we were landing. So these are three pictures that you can see in the upper left here that were taken as the vehicle was descending on towards the surface. This black dot right there, that's the shadow of the parachute. Okay, so the vehicle is descending towards the surface going about 400 kilometers an hour at the point when these pictures are taken. The view on the bottom here is just the same thing being viewed obliquely. Now, the red curve shows the trajectory that the vehicle followed. This is reconstructed after the fact as we landed. So we're coming screaming in from space right here, right here. We fire the rocket motors and drop the airbags to the surface. The airbags fall to the surface, and then the wind, which is blowing from the south, causes the trajectory to bend to the north, bounce, 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 following, or so the trajectory goes like this, and then reading the green perfectly, the trajectory bends to the left and goes right into this little 20-meter impact crater. You know, Tiger Woods on his best day could not have done this landing. It was just pure dumb luck. This shows the same scene, actually, on the same background image. Here's the little crater where we landed. We named it Eagle Crater. That was both named for the Apollo 11 lunar module, but also for the fact that on a par 3, an eagle is a hole-in-one. This is Endurance Crater, named after Ernest Shackleton's ship. And you can see that we started off here, went to Endurance, and then went south from there. This shows the wheel tracks that we made at the top in Eagle Crater and the trajectory, if you will, that we followed during many, many sols. This is about 10 months of operations along the rim and ultimately down inside of Endurance Crater. To summarize the rocks, the character of the rocks here briefly, they're sandstones, all of them. They're very sulfate rich, as you'll see in a moment. They're finely laminated, and then they have these hematite rich spherules embedded within them. These are the things that we famously have come to call blueberries because they're embedded in the rocks like blueberries in a muffin. This shows the sulfur. Well, this shows both. This shows sulfur, chlorine, and bromine. But in particular, look at the SO3 content. Whoops. Look at the SO3 content of these rocks. This is the yellow bars. You can see that SO3 goes as high. Well, it goes higher than 25%. So some of these rocks are 40, even 45% sulfate salts. So an enormously high sulfate salt concentration in these rocks. This came as a substantial surprise to us at first. This is data from our infrared spectrometer taken on the lip of Endurance Crater. Green is hematite, and what you're seeing primarily there is these blueberries and blueberry fragments that are distributed some places within the soil. The blue and purple is basalt. This is basaltic sand that is strewn everywhere. But every place that you see rock exposed, it's the red color, and red is stuff that is rich in sulfates. When you do the mini tests, the infrared spectrometer, mineralogy in detail, this is our best fit model. You notice that it's roughly 40% sulfates, iron sulfate, jarosite at about the 10% level, magnesium sulfate at about the 20% level, calcium sulfate at about the 10% level. So that's our best estimate of the composition of the sulfates from the infrared spectroscopy. The Mossbauer spectrometer provides a definitive observation of jarosite. It's the yellow stuff in this Mossbauer spectrum. Jarosite, the chemical formula is shown right here. It's a particularly environmentally informative mineral in that it typically forms only on Earth under conditions of low pH. pH has to be less than 5, and on Earth it's typically pH of 3 to 1 in which this stuff forms. So it's a pretty strong indicator of acidic conditions here. When we got to the rim of Endurance Crater, we worked along the rim for a while, and then we spent months, about 4 months, very slowly, very laboriously working our way down this particular region here at a place called Kara Tepe, putting together a real stratigraphic section. You can see there's a series of rat holes in this image. If you look carefully, 1, 2, 3, 4, there's a total of 7. Every time we got to a new layer, we would stop. And we would put in a hole with a rock abrasion tool, and we'd look at it with the APXS and the Mossbauer and the microscopic imager, putting together a detailed stratigraphic section. 7 rat holes here, 4 more deeper down in the crater, total stratigraphic section of about 7 meters of rock. There were some substantial changes as we worked our way through. One of the first ones that we noticed was a textural change. Towards the upper part of the section, as you see on the left-hand side here, finely laminated, same kind of stuff that we had seen many other places. But once you got deeper, we crossed a line at one point, and all of a sudden what we started to see was the lamination was gone, and instead you got this sort of knobby texture that looks like it's indicative of some kind of recrystallization process that has wiped out the lamination. This shows the contact right here. You can see the finely laminated stuff above here. This much more complex. You can still see a little bit of preserved lamination here. It becomes fainter and fainter the deeper you go. And there is the contact. Notice that it doesn't quite exactly line up with the laminations here. We interpret this as a diagenetic contact, effectively a bathtub ring. And the water sort of rose, groundwater within the sediments kind of rose to a certain level, causing the recrystallization textures to develop from here on down, but not from here on up. And there's also a very distinct change in the chemistry as soon as you cross this line. This shows the chemistry. This is a very complicated plot. It's got too many elements plotted, but I'll call your attention primarily to magnesium and sulfur, the red and the yellow curves. This is just different units as a function of depth. You're getting deeper and deeper as you move to the right on this plot. So this is deep in the section. This is high in the section. We've normalized them all to this unit D here. Unit D is right where that dividing line is between the recrystallized and the unrecrystallized stuff. And what you find is once you get below that dividing line, you see magnesium and sulfur go down, and they track together. Okay, so this is magnesium sulfate, and you get less and less magnesium sulfate as you go deeper and deeper into the crater. What goes up is primarily silicon and aluminum. So silicon and aluminum are increasing at the same time that magnesium and sulfur are decreasing. This is another way of plotting this, and what we tried to do is capture a lot of geochemical information on this one plot here. And what we're really trying to get at here is the composition of the non-sulfate stuff. The sulfate stuff we can see pretty well with our spectrometers, and we got a good sense of what it is. Like I said, it's this mixture of magnesium, calcium, sulfates, and jarosite. But the question is, what's the other stuff? And what you see here, this is a plot in which what we've got on this axis is aluminum divided by the sum of iron, magnesium, and calcium, the major divalent cations that are present in the sulfates. And then on this axis, what we have is the total amount of SO3. The data points are given by these black dots here. This is the ones that are shallow, and as you go deeper and deeper, more aluminum, less of the divalent cations, and less of the sulfur. And what this curve here is, this is a mixing line. Turns out on a plot like this, a mixing line has this shape. It intersects at this end at the composition of the chemical end member, if you will, the sulfates. And then if you follow it, what it does is it runs into this axis at a composition that should be indicative of the composition of the leftover stuff. Okay, the siliciclastic fraction, if you will, of this rock. And the key thing here is that it is substantially different in composition from any Martian basalts. These are all different Martian basalts here. They plot right there. And what we infer from this is that there's been a significant depletion, something like 55% of the total of iron, magnesium, and calcium, and it's mostly magnesium, has been removed. So you have some basaltic precursor. It interacts with an aqueous solution, probably very acidic. A lot of the iron, the magnesium, the calcium, particularly the magnesium, comes out of the rock. You get a residual, you get a residue left behind that is rich in silicon and rich in aluminum. That's the siliciclastic fraction of this rock. And then the sulfur that's in the sulfuric acid that creates this action combines with the divalent cations that have been removed, and you get precipitation of iron, magnesium, and calcium sulfates. Then there are the spherules, the famous blueberries. We were very eager to find out what these were made of. The problem with measuring these things, we've got a Mossbauer spectrometer that's a great hematite detector. We suspected that this was where the hematite was. The problem is that the blueberries are little tiny things, 4 or 5 millimeters in size, and the field of view of the Mossbauer spectrometer is 1.5 centimeters. And so when you try to go up and isolate one of these things, you get just a little bit of blueberry and a whole lot of muffin in your field of view, and it messes up your observation. So what we needed was a gathering of blueberries. And we found it. There was a little bowl-shaped depression in the rock that we called the berry bowl, and it was a clustering of blueberries there. So we stuffed our Mossbauer spectrometer inside. And there's two measurements here. There's the yellow one, which is right next door to it, and then the blue one, which is the thing labeled Mossberry, is the berry spot. And it's very, very rich. You can see that sextet spectrum there, extremely rich in hematite. So there's a very high concentration of hematite in these things. We have not yet been able to say definitively how much hematite there is in the blueberries. It's at least 50%, could be more than that. A number of aspects of these hematite spherules have led us to conclude that they are concretions. One, of course, is the mineralogy. Another is aspects of the morphology. You see doublets where you see two of these things sort of merged together. There are a number of instances where you can find a spherule that has a stripe running across it, like the stripe on a croquet ball. And you can see that it's aligned with the layers in the nearby rock. That's a characteristic that's common of concretions. A particularly interesting characteristic of these things is that if you look at their spatial distribution in a quantitative sense using nearest neighbor statistics, what you find is that their spatial distribution is more uniform than random. They are not randomly distributed within the rock. They are certainly not clustered. In fact, they're the opposite of clustered. They're spaced apart one from another in a fairly regular sense. And this is the kind of thing that concretions do, because concretions, of course, grow from a fluid that saturates the rock, and each sort of carves out its own zone and forms at the expense of the other ones around it. And so the spatial distribution, the volumetric distribution, if you will, of these things is consistent with them being concretions as well. Let me talk now a little bit about the sedimentology and the stratigraphy. Much of what we know about the sedimentology and stratigraphy comes from this place here. This is a place on the wall of the Durance Crater that we named Burns Cliff, after the late Roger Burns, who was an early advocate of there being lots of sulfate chemistry on the surface of Mars. This shows the 7-meter stratigraphic section. I won't read you through this in detail because I'm going to take you through each of the units. But there are basically three units: lower unit here, an erosional contact; a middle unit here, that diagenetic contact; and then an upper unit. The lower unit is Aeolian dune material. The middle unit we interpret as being Aeolian sand sheet. And then in the upper portion of the upper unit is where you find some of these subaqueous ripples. This is the lower unit, the thing that we interpret to be Aeolian dune deposits. And I will show you at the very end of the talk some spectacular images that just came down a few days ago that shows far better Aeolian dune cross stratification even than this. But there's a high angle truncation with the overlying unit, some low angle internal truncations, and generally much coarser lamination in this unit than you see in the overlying units. The middle unit has these very fine pinstripe laminations. There are some of these laminae that you can see in this microscopic image are just a single grain thick and well sorted within individual laminae. Very characteristic of Aeolian sand sheets. Some very low angle truncations within this. The upper unit is where we see very fine scale festoon or trough geometry cross stratification or cross lamination. This is a rock called Scoop that we saw very early on in the mission. You can see these kind of concave upwards forms here in the rock. This is a scale of only 5 centimeters in this rock. This is some data collected by Dave Rubin at the USGS in Menlo Park with some flume experiments that show what happens when you have water flowing over sand. Produces ripples. The key here is that the ripples have extremely sinuous crests, and that's the signature of water as being the fluid that's flowing over the sand. Again, work by Dave Rubin here. This is the same thing being simulated in the computer with ripples propagating downstream, highly sinuous crest lines. And the key is what's left behind. When viewed from this geometry rather than nice flat-lying layers, what you get are these concave upward cross laminations on very small scales, typically scales of 5 centimeters, 10 centimeters, something like that, that are the signature of these propagating ripples. Again, from Dave Rubin, here is the real thing. This is from sediments in the Colorado River in the southwestern United States. And here we are on Mars. This is a rock called Overgaard. You can see these beautifully preserved concave upward cross laminations at several locations within that rock. Here's another really good example. This is right next to Overgaard. This is a rock called Cornville. You can see these concave upward cross laminations all through this rock. And here's an example. This is an Archean cross laminated sandstone from Earth, American penny for scale. And you can see these cross laminations. And here's the same thing at the exact same scale on Mars. Really startling similarity between this. So we interpret this as evidence that at this location, occasionally, we don't see a lot of this stuff. This is fairly unusual. But occasionally, water came to the surface and flowed across the surface. Most of the signature of water that we see here is groundwater, the dissolution of the magnesium sulfates producing that chemical gradient within the rock, the precipitation of the spherules. But in this instance, evidence that at least at this one location, water came to the surface. So, brief geologic history of this location. All of the rocks here are composed of sulfate-rich sandstone. There were groundwater fluctuations that took place that led to dissolution of some of the minerals, the magnesium sulfates, formation of the concretions. Surface environment was probably primarily these sulfate-rich Aeolian deposits, dunes and sand sheets, with occasional interdune playas that were fed by acidic groundwater. Now, of course, much is made of what this means in terms of the habitability of the planet. Certainly, this environment was, quote, habitable in the sense that liquid water was present. But I think it could have posed some significant challenges to life, and particular to the origin of life. Clearly, conditions were oxidizing. Clearly, conditions were acidic. Clearly, conditions were highly saline. And it was an arid and only intermittently wet surface environment. So this was definitely no evolutionary paradise. We have found some other interesting things that I will go through very quickly. One thing that we have found, this is a rock called Escher, but we've seen a number of other ones like this. Fairly commonly on rocks at Meridiani, we see networks of polygonal fractures on the surface. We got very excited the first time we saw this. We thought, mud cracks, until we looked at the rock carefully and realized, well, wait a second, they're orthogonal to the bedding, so it's something else. In fact, we see these lacing in a three-dimensional structure the surfaces of boulders. What we think is going on here is that, as I'm sure many of you are aware, these sulfates, magnesium sulfates, calcium sulfates, can contain an enormous amount of bound water, you know, MgSO4.xH2O, where X is a pretty big number. And what happens is if you form these things in a fairly wet environment and then you gradually let the environment desiccate, what will happen is the thermodynamically stable phase will be one that has less water in it. These rocks will dehydrate. They can lose some of their water to the atmosphere. It diffuses out, and there's a substantial volume change. This stuff shrinks. The rocks shrink as they dehydrate. And we think that these networks of polygonal fractures are probably due to dehydration of these sulfate salts. While all of the bedrock, every single piece of bedrock, and most of the loose pieces of rock that we have seen at Meridiani have been composed of this sulfate-rich stuff, there have been a few oddballs. This is one that we call bounce rock. We named it that because it was right next to an airbag bounce mark. This is the only rock for half a mile in every direction. And if you know the history of our mission, you'll know that it makes perfect sense that if there's one rock that you could possibly hit in the process of landing, we would manage to find it. But fortunately, bounce rock did not kill our lander. And we went over, and we worked this over pretty thoroughly. It looks totally different from any other Martian rock that we have seen. When you look at the Mossbauer spectrum, it is pure pyroxene. The only iron-bearing mineral that we see in this rock is pyroxene. It's a laboratory quality pyroxene spectrum. You don't see anything else in this rock. This is a complicated chart showing the elemental chemistry. I won't take it through you element by element. I will simply make the point that it looks very close in composition to this rock right here, which I'm sure is familiar to Colin, EETA79001. It's a Martian meteorite. It's a SNCC meteorite. So we're very proud of this. We went all the way to Mars and we found a Martian rock. But this is the one rock that we found that really matches up pretty well with a SNCC meteorite. This particular lithology B of this particular rock is very rich in pyroxene, has no olivine in it. It's a very good match to bounce rock. We think bounce rock may actually be a piece of ejecta from a distant crater. There's a crater that's 25 kilometers in diameter and 40 kilometers away. And if you look at it from orbit in the infrared, you can actually see rays of ejecta from that crater crossing our landing ellipse. And so we think this may be a hunk of, not this, but this may be a hunk of rock that was tossed out of that crater. So a sample of the Martian crust from tens of kilometers away and maybe a couple of kilometers down. This one we called heat shield rock. This thing was sitting right next to the heat shield. We went to investigate the lander's heat shield, and in the process of looking at it, we found this rock here. We went over and investigated it. Here's a Mossbauer spectrum. This is camosite. This thing is a nickel iron meteorite. I told the team we should not stay here. This is obviously the place where big metal objects fall from the sky. But just a beautiful fit to an iron meteorite. And we found now a total of four meteorites, two with each rover. Okay, so this shows our landing site and some of the sites that we visited along the way. Here's Eagle Crater, where we landed. Here's Endurance Crater, where we did all that stratigraphy and sedimentology. We drove by Vostok Crater, Erebus Crater. Here's Beagle Crater, right there. And as we were doing this, we were heading south. You can see a 500-meter scale bar here. South is towards the right. The goal, since almost the day we landed, was this thing here, the geologic promised land, Victoria Crater. And it's a place that we strived for 21 months to try to reach. Along the way, we saw some interesting things. As we worked our way southward, we were going slightly higher in topography. We were going up just a little, maybe 5 or 10 meters at most. And what we found, interestingly enough, was as we went south, the blueberries in the rocks got smaller and then they went away completely. This is an image that shows, this is a microscopic imager picture, and it shows nothing but very tiny blueberries. And in fact, once you get higher up stratigraphically, the blueberries go away completely. This is something we saw along our traverse. Then, interestingly enough, when we got to this, there's this annulus, this kind of smooth annulus of material around Victoria Crater. When we got to that, the big blueberries appeared. All of a sudden, there's great big juicy blueberries in the soil again. So I'm going to tell you a story. I don't know if this is true or not, but it's a story for how this might have happened. Imagine you have these layered sediments deposited. Water comes in, and it rises to some level. Blueberries are precipitated from the groundwater up to that level, but above it, where the water doesn't rise, you don't make blueberries. The water goes away, and then you plane this off by erosion, but you don't quite plane it off totally flat. There's a slight slope upwards towards the right, towards the south, which in fact we see in the topography. Victoria Crater forms. It excavates down into the blueberry-rich stuff and throws blueberries out onto the annulus. So here's our landing site. Here's the place where we have either the microberries or no berries. Here's the place where we have the big berries again. What's going to be there? We're interested to see when we get down inside of Victoria Crater. At just about exactly the time when we arrived at the rim of Victoria Crater, a wonderful camera called HiRISE on a wonderful spacecraft called the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter was turned on for the first time, and during the first week of operations, the HiRISE team was kind enough to take a picture of Victoria Crater for us. And this shows Victoria Crater at a resolution, well, you can't see it on this screen, the resolution is 30 centimeters per pixel, and when you zoom in on just the right place, there's opportunity. You can even see the shadow of the mast on the surface. It was very good to see our rover again. It really was. As we speak right now, opportunity is right there at the tip of a place that we've called Cape Verde. We do not intend to drive forward from our current location and is surveying the interior of Victoria Crater. Let me just give you two quick teasers of what we're beginning to see in Victoria. This is a picture that came down a few weeks ago. Look at the layered materials. There's a very distinctive, coarsely layered facies down here within this unit. And you can measure the thickness of this, and it's 40% thicker here than it is here. It thins by 40% over a lateral distance of just 20 meters. So what this says is that we can possibly expect to see lateral facies variations here. And because we have these wonderful, there are these promontories all around the rim of this crater. This crater has enlarged, and there are these promontories all the way around the rim. And at each one of those promontories, we can do pan-cam imaging from the rim. We can do vertical stratigraphy, but think of those as being a set of boreholes, if you will. And what we're going to do is put together kind of a circumferential fence diagram, working our way around this crater and looking at lateral facies variations over scales of hundreds of meters as we work our way around this crater. Then just to really entice you a little bit, this picture just came down 2 days ago, and it's some layered sediments at the bottom of the promontory that we're closest to now, one named Cape St. Mary. And look at this cross-stratification here, here. The scale, by the way, from the base of this cliff to the top is probably 4 or 5 meters. So this is a substantial stack of rocks. This is the best Aeolian cross-stratification that we've ever seen on Mars. So we think there's a lot of good stuff still to come. I'm hoping to go into this crater. It would be a gross misrepresentation of the facts for me to give you anything like the impression that this is all or mostly or even a little bit my work. Okay, I am a member of an exceptional team of scientists. Here are their names. There are their smiling faces below. It's a wonderful team of scientists, and I'm very proud to be associated with them. I will also stress that these rovers were built by an extraordinary group of engineers. These are people who were dedicated, committed, passionate. This is one of my favorite pictures from the whole mission. This is a small, tiny fraction of the engineering team dressed up in our funny white suits down in Florida. That's Opportunity in the background just before we sent her out to the launch pad. For every one of us who has had the wonderful experience of being part of this mission. It has been, in the very literal sense of the phrase, the adventure of a lifetime. And I want to really thank you for inviting me here to tell you about it. Thank you. And I'd be happy to do some questions.
Steve, I hope you'll take some questions because there's some very interested geologists in the audience.
Sure. Fire away.
Come on, who's first? Don't be bashful.
Interested but bashful. There we go.
Stuart Hurst, he's not a geologist. He's an engineer.
After your 1,012 souls on Mars, are you more or less optimistic in finding evidence of life, or not you, but their evidence of life will be found on Mars?
It's hard to say. I think that what this has shown us is that early interpretations, going back as far as Mariner 9, that liquid water has been present below the surface and at the surface of Mars, were correct. There has been water on Mars. That's been believed since we first saw valleys in the Mariner 9 images, and I think our data show that. But you can go much more beyond just saying, yeah, there was water on Mars. At these locations, particularly at the Opportunity site, which is, I guess, the more favorable of the two, as I said, there are a number of things here that would be really, I think, very daunting for life. The acidity, the highly oxidizing character, the highly saline environment. Now, you can go to very acidic, very oxidizing, very saline environments on Earth, and they're teeming with life. They're teeming with microbes. You can find bugs that are perfectly happy at a pH of 1, acidophiles. But those are organisms that developed first under more neutral, more normal, if you will, conditions, and then managed to find a way to evolve into that very challenging ecological niche. If you go to one of these acidophiles and you measure the pH of their environment, the pH outside their cell membrane is 1, but the pH inside is 7. Okay, and they have these wonderful ion pumps across their cell membranes that keep them at a neutral pH inside. So while life can exist in that kind of environment, whether or not it can get started in that environment is another question. Now, one thing that you got to keep in mind is that these two places are just two little pinpricks on the surface of an incredibly diverse and complicated planet. For example, the Omega instrument on the Mars Express, the European Mars Express mission, French instrument, and also now the CRISM instrument on MRO, have both detected phyllosilicates, clay minerals, in some locations on Mars that may be indicative of a more neutral pH at some point. So there are it's a complicated story that's still evolving. There are a number of places where we see both morphologic and mineralogical evidence for water on the surface of Mars. In terms of the habitability, yeah, it was habitable, but it was a challenge. I think we've still got a lot of work to do. I think what we need to do is send instruments like Collins' instrument package to the surface of Mars and look for organics, and I think we need to bring some rocks back.
John Bridges?
You haven't found, or haven't reported, is carbonate, which is what people have been looking out for decades, one way or the other. Do you think that's because it's been broken down, or do you think it's because it never formed in the first place?
I don't think it formed in large quantities in the first place. Now, of course, carbonates have been found in Martian meteorites at fairly low levels. But the massive carbonate deposits that many people expected to find on Mars, I'm beginning to suspect simply are not there. Now, I can tell you that there's no carbonates at the 5%, 10% level in rocks and soils at our landing sites. I think just as convincingly and perhaps more significantly, infrared spectrometers with a wonderful capability to detect carbonates down to like the 5% level have viewed the entire planet from orbit and haven't found any carbonates. So while there are low levels of carbonates in Martian rocks, clearly the massive carbonate deposits that people have hypothesized were where all the CO2 is hiding You know, the idea is you once had a much more massive CO2 atmosphere, you had a dense greenhouse, and then somehow you take all that carbon, all that CO2, and you sequester it, and you hide it in carbonate rocks on the surface. Those massive carbonates don't appear to be there. They certainly are not there at our landing sites, and while I won't claim that our landing sites are representative of Mars, because clearly they are not, you don't see them in the orbital data either. It may be pretty hard to precipitate carbonates when most of your groundwater is sulfuric acid. So I think you need you may need a different way of hiding a lot of that CO2.
John Murray?
You talked about the evidence for substantial amounts of flowing water at the surface due to cross-bedding.
Yeah.
Have you seen any evidence at all for morphological evidence of that, I mean from orbital pictures and so forth? And if not, what do you think's happened here?
Well, first of all, I hope I didn't give the impression that it was a substantial amount of subaqueous flow at the surface. We have seen a little bit of that at Eagle Crater. We saw a little bit of it at Endurance. We saw the best exposures kind of on the plains between Endurance and Victoria Crater. But we're talking literally a handful of outcrops with physical length scales of a few meters in all the rocks that we've looked at. So it's not a common phenomenon by any means. As far as morphologic evidence for fluid flow, no, we have seen none. But I think the clear reason for that is that there has been a substantial amount of post-depositional erosion of the rocks at Meridiani Planum. Those sulfate rocks are extremely soft. They're very, very friable, very erodible. The surface soil here is mostly basaltic sand that's blown in from somewhere, and it's saltating across the surface, and it's abrading continuously these sulfate rocks, and they're extremely soft, and they erode away very, very effectively. We see some craters that are very fresh with lots of rubble around the exterior. Beagle Crater is a good example. We see other former craters that are nothing other than kind of a flat ring of rocks on the surface where it's just been completely planed off. At one of the craters that we examined, a crater called Fram Crater that we saw very early in the mission, lots of blocky rubble around the crater rim, so it's clearly a fairly fresh crater. And it turns out the hematite spherules are very, very hard, but the rock in which they're embedded is soft. And what's happening is the rock erodes away and the spherules fall out. But we would actually see, because there's a prevailing wind direction and hence a prevailing saltation direction, we call them blueberries on a stick. You would see this little hematite spherule out at the end of a thin finger of rock that had not quite eroded away yet. So this is very soft, very crumbly stuff, easy to abrade into with the rock abrasion tool. And whatever original topography existed there, this sandblasting and planation and erosion of the stuff has just cut down through it. So I wouldn't expect to see that preserved.
Heather? Heather's down here.
Get Heather a microphone.
The one person in the audience is most used to a microphone, and we can't get it.
do your data give you any indication as to whether Mars is currently volcanically active? Or
no.
It doesn't?
No.
And does it give you an indication as to when the volcanic activity actually ended?
Unfortunately, the answer to both of those is no. The rocks at both of our sites are quite old, particularly at the Gusev site. The rocks are probably 3.5 billion years old on the plains and even significantly older than that in the hills. That's just based on the density of superimposed impact craters. So there's clearly been no recent volcanic activity at either one of our sites. We're looking at very ancient rocks. With respect to determining the age, we don't have any instrumentation on board that is remotely close to being able to do that. People are working hard to try to come up with radiometric age dating hardware that could actually be put on a remote vehicle. I think the best way to do it is to bring some samples back. But until we get some good samples into laboratories on Earth and really do the systematic radiometric age dating, well, it's going to be very hard to say.
Can I come in with a comment on that? Because
yeah.
79001 is the youngest Martian meteorite.
Mm-hmm.
And you say you found a piece that looks like it.
It looks similar. Yeah.
Interesting question. In the middle there?
The peculiar crenulated edge of Victoria Crater.
Yeah.
What are the team's ideas on this, and what might you find out now you're there?
Well, the one thing that I think we can say with certainty is that that crater used to be smaller than it is now. Okay, that crenulated, I mean, craters don't form with a shape like that, and so that crenulated rim speaks to some kind of enlargement process, probably involving a fair amount of kind of slumping and mass wasting that has created those alcoves. The really good thing about that, say if you go to a fresh crater, what you're going to find is a lot of piled up rubble on the rim, and then a crater wall that's undergone a substantial amount of fracturing and deformation as well. But what happens is if you then erode back into that, you're going to be eroding into less and less deformed rock. And in fact, oh, we seem to have lost the image. I wanted to, is there a way to wake our projector back
up? Can we get the image back?
I can see it. There you go. If you look at this, what you see on many of these promontories at, in fact, all of them, as far as we can see, at Victoria Crater, is there is a lower portion that tends to be almost vertical that consists of really intact bedrock with very little fracturing, very little disruption, and then there's a very distinct break that coincides to both, there's both a break in slope where it's a gentler slope above that and a very distinct change in character from intact bedrock to rubble. And what you're seeing here, I believe, this is the original country rock surrounding the crater, and we've eroded back into it. And then what you're getting into here is as soon as you get above this, you get into the ejecta blanket. And everything that you see here is the rubble, the ejecta that was thrown out of the crater. And because of the enlargement of this crater, what that means is because it has eaten back into relatively undeformed rock, you get wonderful situations like this where there's not a whole lot of disruption of this rock, and you've got a really pretty nice stratigraphic section. So I think we're going to be able to do some very nice stratigraphy here once we start working our way around and eventually into this crater.
Front here.
It's been hypothesized that the Viking biology results could be explained if there were a lot of peroxides and hyperoxides mm-hmm. on the surface. Do any of your data confirm that?
No, we don't have instrumentation that really directly addresses that. So I can't say too much about that. I'm sorry.
I was wondering, the process you described with the water, subsurface water, forming the hematite, the blueberries, mm-hmm. Is there any indication from all the data you've got when that process took place on Mars?
Again, we really can't get to time scales. All I can tell you is that it was after the original deposition of those sediments, but the timing, whether it was 1,000 years or a week or 1,000,000 years or 10 million years, I can't tell you. No way of knowing. Again, we got to get some rocks back.
Somebody down here.
How many more sets of 90 days do you think you're going to get out of your two vehicles?
When will this end? My wife keeps asking me that.
Does she expect you back?
I think she's hoping to get me back. It's impossible to say at this point. I really mean that. We had a design requirement of 90 sols in order to convince ourselves and to convince our sponsors at NASA that the vehicle could survive that. For example, we tested all of our key components to three times that, 270 thermal cycles. We have a lot of motors and actuators, and we tested those to four times their design number of revolutions. Well, we're now at 10 times the design number of revolutions, and we're at 1,000 sols instead of 270. So we are doing lifetime testing of components to a higher level of validation than has ever been done on Earth at the surface of Mars. And they're going to die when they die, and I don't have the slightest clue when it's going to happen.
Hopefully a long time.
I hope it's going to be a long time. We are seeing components start to fail. The right front drive motor, the right front wheel on Spirit won't turn anymore. And so in order to drive that vehicle, we have to drive it backwards, dragging a wheel. And, for example, we're never going to climb another mountain with that rover because we used to be able to climb 30, 33-degree slopes, and now we can climb 8 or 10-degree slopes. On Opportunity, we have lost the ability to steer the right front wheel. Now, all the other steering motors work fine, and that hasn't handicapped us too much. On Opportunity, there is a winding in the motor that moves the arm back and forth at the shoulder joint, and that winding has broken. Now, we have redundant windings, and the thing still works if we apply a different voltage to it, but we're one broken wire away from losing that motor entirely and then having a 4-degree of freedom arm. So things are starting to break on these vehicles. It could be mechanical wear that gets us. We could have some electronic parts failure that we never see coming. There's very little redundancy in these vehicles. Now, of course, we have the ultimate redundancy in that we have two vehicles, but there's very little electrical redundancy in these vehicles, and so you know you could have some electronic parts failure, and the rover just doesn't wake up tomorrow. So we recognize that every day could be our last, and while we have plans that extend for many months into the future for both vehicles, each day we try to drive it like there's no tomorrow because that could be the reality.
Over there? On the end, I think. Sorry, it's Jerry Stone.
Thanks. Two questions. Firstly, could you say something about the process? If somebody sees something in one of the pictures on the team, they say, well, they'd like to investigate that further. I presume that there's lots of people all looking at different things.
And they all have different ideas.
Yes.
Every single one of them.
So how does that go through, and how long would it take then until the rover actually gets to one of those spots?
Okay.
And as a second question, when we do get a Mars sample return, what kind of rock would you like to have brought back?
Very, very good questions. With respect to the first question, yeah, I mean, every time you take a panorama, every time you get some new data, there are going to be many ideas for things that you can do with these vehicles, and the vehicle can't do them all. Every day, well, we plan on two different timescales. We have a long-range plan, and I have one group within the team that is just in charge of long-term planning. And they are the ones who sort of, you know, keep our eye on the ball in terms of, okay, you can do what you want to do today, but 2 weeks from now, we got to be here. You know, and that keeps us moving forwards towards a well-established set of goals. But then we also have a daily tactical planning process in which each day we try to come up with a plan that it makes the best use of the rover on that day while still being consistent with the long-term plan. That daily tactical planning process is really interesting because each morning, you know, we come into it with a new set of data from overnight, and we've got a set of activities that we have to plan, and we have many more things in mind than the rover can actually do. And so it's a daily process that we've been doing for 1,000 days now on two vehicles of achieving consensus among a bunch of ornery scientists and getting the job done. And I'm proud to say we've actually gotten quite good at it. I think a thing that has really helped us in achieving consensus has been the longevity of the rovers. As we began to become more confident that these things were not going to die after 90 sols, but they were going to last for longer than that, it became a lot easier to kind of work out trades. Okay, we're not going to do your science today because we got to do this, but I promise we'll do it next week. You know, and as long as there's a next week, that works. And so what we've managed to do is because of the very extended time over which these vehicles have managed to exist, just about every cockamamie idea that somebody on my team has come up with, we've managed to chase down at one time or another. Almost everybody has had their pet observation made, in many cases, many times. So it has been possible to achieve consensus. And that's if you look at some of the names on this, if you can imagine trying to get all those people to agree on what to do with this rover, especially if you know some of these people, I'm very proud of this. With respect to which samples to bring back, that's really tough. I'm actually a pretty big advocate of, because sample return is going to be so costly and so difficult, and because one of the things that I have learned from this mission is it's very, very difficult to accurately predict from orbital data what you're going to find at a landing site. I mean, people had a lot of ideas about what these places were going to be like, but there wasn't anybody who talked about hematite blueberries at the Meridiani site before we landed. I'm a big advocate of going to some place that you've already been. In other words, you go there with a lander, you go there with a rover, you characterize it at a very simple level, and then once you really want to know, you know, what's going on, you bring rocks back. I think a reasonable strategy, for example, would be to send, say, the MSL rover or ExoMars to a site like one of these places where there are phyllosilicates, where there appear to be phyllosilicates from orbit. Set down there with a good science package, really do the geology there well. Do as many sites as you can like that. Certainly Meridiani would be a good candidate. These phyllosilicate sites might be an even better candidate. I don't know. Go to two or three or four more places on the Martian surface, maybe just one more if you're in a hurry. Characterize it, figure out which it is, and then once you've got that information, bring rocks back from that place. If I had to choose from among the five landing sites that we have on Mars right now, the two Viking sites, Pathfinder, Spirit, and Opportunity, I would definitely pick the Opportunity site. It's the most interesting one so far, but Mars has a lot more to offer.
I think we've exhausted the audience, but let me say one thing now, that if anybody ever meets you and asks you what Colin Pillinger feels now, you can say he is so totally converted to the power of rovers that if he was going, he'd send four. And if he
I think there's a proposal in here someplace.
Yeah.
But
the last thing that they don't know about, of course, that you'll meet people, you can say he's such a zealot for rovers, he actually drives around on one.
That's right.
Bob, can I give you the floor?
Thank you very much.
Well, it's my privilege to offer a formal vote of thanks to Steve. But before I do that, there's one other thing I'd like to do. When Phil gave his introduction, he probably gave you the wrong idea that I have something to do with organizing these lectures. In fact, it's not me. It's really Anita Chabra, who makes all the phone calls, who contacts all the people in the OU, and who does all the stuff that I simply don't know how to do and probably couldn't do well anyway. So Anita has been the driving force behind this series so far. So I'd just like to formally thank Anita for her contribution. Thank you, Anita. Well, I first, in a sense, met Steve at the Brighton Festival. Not that he was actually there. He was on the other end of a video link, and it was Colin on the stage along with myself and Phil in JPL, I think you were at the time. And it struck me what a wonderful person Steve was. He was being extraordinarily generous to, at that time, what we thought might be, in a sense, a competitor to what you were doing. And since then, he's continued to be extremely supportive of what we've been doing here. And I'm really pleased that you were able to come along. You almost feel like a family friend. And certainly, I know there's a great deal of warmth between Colin and yourself. And I would also like to thank you as a field geologist for taking me on the most amazing field trip I think I've ever been on. I'd love to go there. Yeah. Wouldn't you?
I want to drive down to that yeah. spot and just drive up. The problem is, you see that dark stuff there? That's a shadow.
Yeah.
And it's a solar-powered
yeah.
vehicle, so you've got to
yeah.
be careful.
Okay, well, we'll give you that one. But hey, you know. I was saying earlier on that, I'm coming towards the end of my academic career and also lifetime, I suppose. I'm looking forward a few years, hopefully, yet. I want to get the money out of the pension fund, apart from anything else. But, hey, you know, if it was a one-way trip, I'd really like to go at some point. That looks so interesting. So thank you for bringing it alive for us in such a wonderful way. And good luck in the future. And may you have many more rovers. And thank you very much, Steve.